You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Number 18, Roe against Wade. Mrs. Weddington, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The instant case is a direct appeal from a decision of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas. The court declared the Texas abortion law to be unconstitutional for two reasons. First, that the law was impermissibly vague, and second, that it violated a woman's right to determine to continue or terminate a pregnancy.
That's the voice of Chief Justice Warren Burger and Sarah Weddington, the opening oral arguments of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, that legalized abortion nationwide and made abortion legal for all 9 months from the moment of conception all the way to the moment of birth. Did you know that? That's one of the things people don't know often about Roe v. Wade. Maybe there are more things you don't know about Roe v. Wade. You know, maybe that was bad law. How bad was it? Why was it bad law? How was it argued before the court? What was the court like leading up to Roe v. Wade? And how did that case actually get there? Under what circumstances, or we might even say, under what legal pretense did it make its way to the Supreme Court? And did it solve the problems that the advocates of Roe then and now say it solved? Greetings, welcome to Issues Etc. on this Sunday night, January the 29th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the real history of Roe v. Wade. Joining us to do so, Clark Forsythe. He's acting president and senior counsel for Americans United for Life and author of the definitive book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. Clark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be with you.
What do you think is the biggest myth still believed by many Americans when it comes to that landmark court decision, Roe v. Wade?
Well, most Americans don't understand what Roe did. And the first and biggest, I think, is that they think that Roe versus Wade only legalized abortion in the first 3 months of pregnancy. And they don't realize that the court legalized abortion for any reason, at any time, across all 50 states.
Where do you think that myth came from? Because the decision seems pretty clear if you read it. Where did the three-month-only myth come from?
Well, it started with the New York Times headline the day after, which was January 23rd. And which happened to coincide with the death of former President Johnson. So that was the big headline of the day, who had died on the same day, on the 22nd. So on the 23rd, the New York Times announces the death of Johnson, President Johnson, and Roe slipped below the major headline. But the New York Times said legalized in the first 3 months. The decision, though, ties, I mean, it is, you know, 50, 60 pages long. It's confusing. The court repeats itself a couple of times in different language. So if you read the decision that day, it would not be clear what happens in the second trimester or the third trimester, the last 3 months. And then you had years of federal courts kind of debating what the decision meant, or at least discussing it. And so there have been a lot of contributing factors to the confusion.
Let's talk about the players in the Roe v. Wade decision. How would you introduce us to the people who actually made it happen?
Well, first and foremost, it was the nine justices. First, it was the seven who first heard the case because there were two vacancies. And as I point out in abuse of discretion, as you know, the cases were first decided to be heard by the court when it had nine justices. And then in September 1971, before the first round of arguments, two of the justices, Justice Black and Justice Harlan, retired in September 71 within the space of a week due to ill health. Black died from cancer immediately that week. Justice Harlan died from cancer at the end of the year. I think both of them would have voted against a national right to abortion. So you had seven justices, Blackmun, Berger, and then there were four. Justice White would be the other. And then there were four liberals who were very pro-abortion and wanted to legalize abortion. And those were Justice Douglas, Justice Brennan, Justice Stewart, and Justice Thurgood Marshall. So those were the seven who first heard the case. And then before the cases were reheard, Justice Powell and Justice Rehnquist joined the court as Nixon appointees. So those were the nine who eventually heard the case the second time around, and those are the nine who voted finally to legalize abortion by a vote of 7-2. Rehnquist and White were the only two dissenters.
How did the case come to the Supreme Court, if you could, its path from the lower courts up to the highest court?
Well, the cases were filed in Texas and Georgia. Roe versus Wade was filed in Texas. Doe versus Bolton was filed in Atlanta, Georgia. But these were only two of probably 20 or more cases on abortion that were filed against state laws. So there were cases in many other states. And it's possible that the court could have heard a case from Illinois or Kentucky or Missouri, but they ended up hearing these two cases, and Roe versus Wade became, of course, the most famous. But they were filed in federal court in Texas and Georgia, and the cases were first heard not really on the issue of abortion, but on or jurisdictional issues, procedural issues that would bore everybody who wasn't a lawyer. And the court first agreed to hear the cases not to decide a right to abortion. They were planning to address the jurisdictional or procedural issues. And they took the cases in April of 71 to hear those kind of mundane procedural issues. But after Black and Harlan retired in September 71, it flipped the balance of the court. It reduced the number of justices to seven. And it empowered a temporary majority of four justices, who I mentioned before, Brennan, Douglas, Stewart, and Marshall. They decided to take the cases, forget the procedural issues, and they wanted to legalize the right to abortion, and they voted to do so. And so they took the cases and made them into something they did not begin as, and saw it as an opportunity to legalize abortion and sweep away the abortion laws.
So in other words, the accidents of history, those two resignations due to ill health, really made the biggest difference here in terms of this case being heard by the Supreme Court as merely jurisdictional or procedural issues versus what it actually was heard as. And legalization of abortion.
That's right. The retirements of Black and Harlan in September 71 was the decisive moment, I think. I mean, there were other major factors, as I point out, in abuse of discretion, but that was the decisive moment because it was a historical novelty, two vacancies at the same time, and it flipped the balance of the court and really set the cases on a trajectory toward legalizing abortion. I think if Black and Harlan had stayed on the court, the result might have been 5-4, 6-3 against a national right to abortion.
Would you go so far as to say that that temporary four justice majority on the court decided in advance what they wanted to do with this case?
Oh, definitely. They decided what they wanted to do, sweep away the abortion laws, declare a right to abortion, and then they had to figure out how to write the opinion. And it took them, Justice Blackmun was assigned the writing of the opinion, but those four, Brennan, Stewart, Douglas, and Marshall, all lobbied Blackmun and prevailed upon him and pressured him to write it a certain way over the course of about 14 months. And the opinion shows, the opinion of Roe versus Wade shows that it was a result-oriented opinion, because they, after they decided what they wanted to do, they had to create a rationale to justify it, which explains in part the confusions in the opinion and why it has been such an unpersuasive opinion, and why scholars and academics and lawyers have been trying to figure out a different rationale ever since.
So what were the issues that the court decided they wanted to hear? We often talk about the court's view of privacy, the court's view of whether or not that right is in the Constitution, or whether, in their terms, it was a penumbra of the Constitution. What were the issues that the court decided they wanted to deal with there?
Well, after they declared a right to abortion, then the question was, how do they justify it? You know, is it in the First Amendment? Is it free speech? Is it privacy? Is it liberty? Is it freedom of religion? What is it? I mean, they were trying to find some hook in the Constitution to justify it, and they eventually, at least in Roe versus Wade, latched upon the privacy theory over the course of several months, because Blackmun's first draft simply said, we're going to strike down these laws because they're vague, if you believe it or not. And eventually they threw that out because it wasn't persuasive, and they latched on to privacy. But in a little noticed part of the opinion, Blackmun says, we've decided a series of cases since about 1900, all involving family decision-making, and we're going to call those privacy cases, and that privacy right is broad enough to encompass abortion. And then he flip-flops two pages later and says, but none of those series of decisions really involve taking of human life, and so they're really inherently different than abortion. And that contradiction has never received enough notice, but it shows the types of defects and contradictions in the Roe v. Wade opinion.
We're talking about the real history of Roe v. Wade on this Sunday night, January the 29th, on Issues Etc. with Clark Forsyth, acting president and senior counsel for Americans United for Life and author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. We'll talk about the oral arguments on both sides after this. Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. reformationgear.com. The new Martin Luther plush figure, reformationgear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Male and female sex differences, contraception, transgenderism. These are some of the topics covered in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, Ethics of Sex, From Taboo to Delight. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Ethics of Sex contributors include Issues, Etc. guests Ben Mays, Tom Eckstein, and Richard Stuckwish. Ethics of Sex, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January.
Oh, morning star, oh, morning star, shine with bright throne.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues, Etc. comment line.
Do you believe that there's not one error in the Bible? That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues, Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the real history of Roe v. Wade, Clark Forsythe. Folks, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and in the culture at large. You can find out more about their great work at lcms.org/life, advocating for the unborn, weak, and vulnerable. LCMS Life Ministry, lcms.org/life. Clark, let's talk about the oral arguments that were heard by the Supreme Court on both sides. How would you characterize what was said?
Well, there were four attorneys in the two cases, and the cases were argued back to back. So there was an hour for Roe versus Wade, then there was an hour for Doe versus Bolton, and then it was repeated. It was done first in December 71 and then repeated again in September or October of 72. And except for one attorney from Georgia, Dorothy Beasley, who did an excellent job, the arguments were superficial and contradictory and very poorly done. I mean, one of the attorneys for Texas who was defending the Texas abortion law said more than 10 times he couldn't answer the question. He didn't know the answers to the question. He didn't know what the answers were. And Dorothy Beasley, who was the assistant attorney general for Georgia and defended the Georgia law, defended a right to life, defended the personhood of the unborn, she was the best arguer of all of the attorneys before the court. And I think that's widely agreed upon. In fact, Todd, you can go to a website called oyez.org, O-Y-E-Z, which is taken from the Supreme Court clerk's initial announcement of the opening of the Supreme Court session to the audience. If you go to oyez.org, you can find the original oral arguments and the transcripts, the audio and the transcripts from Doe versus Bolton and Roe versus Wade, and you can listen to them. And you'll find that Dorothy Beasley was an excellent Supreme Court arguer. She was an experienced Supreme Court arguer. I think this Doe versus Bolton was her fifth case before the Supreme Court, and she was quite articulate and spirited, and had an answer for every question.
What were the arguments on what eventually became the prevailing side? What were they trying to say with respect to abortion privacy?
Well, they were arguing that the court has created a right to privacy in previous cases, and it's broad enough to encompass abortion. And then they talked about the negative impact of unwed pregnancy on adult and young women in the state of Texas or the state of Georgia. And they were arguing basically about the burden of these abortion laws, which didn't apply to women. They didn't prohibit women. They didn't penalize women. They applied to the practitioner. They applied to the doctor or the non-doctor who would do abortions. They didn't penalize women at all. But the proponents were arguing that by prohibiting abortion, you condemn women to negative circumstances, and pregnant women are discriminated against in Texas and Georgia, and it leads them to a life of poverty and so on and so forth. That was the substance.
That's some pretty thin substance. It sounds like what they were arguing was that if a woman is pregnant out of wedlock, that's an interesting detail I want to come back to, that she would have basically to suffer social stigmatization, maybe some economic consequences, and that abortion would be the only way for her to exercise her right to privacy? Is that what they were arguing?
That was a big part of it. And the fact is that there's been a lot of legal and social and change since Roe versus Wade. The assumptions, and it's important to point out that there was no evidentiary record. There was no trial in these cases. There were no expert witnesses. There was no reliable evidence or data about abortion or its implications. Because remember, these cases were first decided on procedural and jurisdictional issues. So there was no trial of evidence. And so what the justices based their decision more on hunches and assumptions and prejudices rather than facts and evidence. And so the proponents, when they were making those arguments, didn't have a lot to hang their hat on. Population control was a subtext to all of this. Justice Stewart was very concerned about population control, as were several of the justices. And Justice Stewart thought that legalizing abortion was a good solution to population control. But there have been a lot of legal and factual changes in America since 1973. When there were legal disabilities, meaning for example, the law might provide for the expulsion of a high school student if she got pregnant in Texas in the 1960s. Well, those laws have been repealed either by the states or by Congress. There are now laws in 50 states that prohibit employment discrimination against pregnant women. There's a federal employment discrimination prohibition law that's been in effect for decades. And so the law, the country has changed a lot since 1973.
How did the issue of viability come into the court's thinking?
It was very much at the end of the whole proceedings, at the end of the whole process, late in 1972. In fact, if you go to that website, oyay.org, and you look at the transcript or you listen to the audio or read the transcript, the word's never mentioned. Viability was never mentioned during the 4 hours of oral arguments. No medical organization urged the court to expand the right to viability. And in fact, if you go to the Library of Congress and you look at some of the personal papers of the justices, you'll see that the original drafts of the opinion never mentioned viability. After the second round of arguments in October of 72, when Justice Blackmun was going through his second or third draft, the justices just started lobbying behind the scenes as to the scope of the right that they were creating. I mean, the first early drafts of the opinions kind of assumed that they were legalizing abortion in the first trimester of the first 12 weeks. Well, after the second round of arguments in November, December of 72, just a month or two before they released the opinions, they started talking among themselves, and two of the justices, Powell and Marshall, kind of lobbied Blackmun to expand the right from 12 weeks to viability, which at that time they thought was 28 weeks of gestation. So in other words, they abruptly decided to expand the right from 12 weeks to 28 weeks, which is 16 weeks or 4 whole months. And they did that without any medical data or evidence. or expert opinion about the implications for live birth abortions, the implications for women's health from late-term abortions. They had nothing. It was just sheer pragmatic decision to expand access.
No embryologist, no OBGYN, not even a midwife, none of that was heard by the court. None of that kind of testimony that could have shed light or at least offered opinions on the issue of viability.
Not in a trial, not through expert witnesses, not through the adversarial process. Some of that information got into the proceedings all for the first time at the Supreme Court level through interest group briefs. There were briefs on both sides, one from Planned Parenthood Federation of America, which was very influential with the court. But on the pro-life side, there were more than 100 pro-life obstetricians and gynecologists who filed a brief with pictures of human development, pictures of the unborn child in the womb, a lot of medical data, but that brief was completely ignored.
You say that there is a medical myth that ultimately drove the outcome of Roe. What was it?
Well, again, without any trial or evidence or expert witnesses, the justices latched on to the notion that abortion is safer than childbirth. And they latched on to this notion based upon numbers, unreliable data taken from Soviet bloc countries in the 1950s, meaning numbers from Czechoslovakia from the 1950s that were put into a brief filed by abortion advocacy group, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and perhaps other briefs. But again, the justices were scrambling for some justification. And I point out in abuse of discretion that the medical numbers that they latched upon from these Eastern European Soviet bloc countries in the 50s was completely unreliable. But they were grasping for straws. They were looking for anything to justify the decision that they had originally made to legalize abortion.
We're talking about the real history of Roe v. Wade with Clark Forsyth, author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. What else did the justices overlook? We'll find out after this.
You can call it what you like. I call it mine.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Located 10 minutes north of Worcester in the heart of liberal Massachusetts, Trinity Lutheran Church in Clinton is a solid, orthodox, confessional, liturgical outpost of the Missouri Synod, where God's word is not changed to agree with the latest social trend. No megachurch fog here, just the law and gospel, every Sunday at 10 a.m., come join us and check us out at TrinityLutheranClintonMA.org.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Sunday night, we're talking with Clark Forsythe, author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade, about the real history of the Supreme Court's decision, Roe v. Wade, that legalized abortion for all 9 months of pregnancy in all 50 states. Clark, what other principal things about the American experience, so to speak, were overlooked by the Roe court majority?
Well, there was a long legal tradition of protecting the unborn child to the greatest extent possible, given, you know, medical understanding. I mean, the law protecting the unborn child goes back centuries, but it was always limited by medical understanding. I mean, imagine living in a world with no medical technology. I mean, no obstetrical gynecological technology, no ultrasound, no stethoscope. Your understanding of when life begins would be very limited. And as the centuries progressed, as medical understanding progressed, our law expanded protection for the unborn child, and eventually in the 20th century it expanded protection. Well, starting in the mid 19th century, going back to the 1830s, 40s, 50s, the laws of the states prohibited abortion from conception. And the courts ignored that and misunderstood it. And they also ignored the fact that the abortion laws were effectively enforced, and they were regularly enforced by the states. I mean, on the eve of Roe versus Wade in 69, 70, 71, 72, the states, including states like California and New York, were actively enforcing abortion laws against providers, against practitioners, not against women, but against the practitioners. And they were effectively enforced. The availability of abortion was limited. And as I point out, there's a chart of statistics from the National Center for Health Statistics going back to 1920 through 1972, showing a precipitous drop in maternal deaths from abortion before Roe versus Wade, and not because of the legalization of abortion, but because of the medical developments and the introduction of antibiotics, which treated infection after abortion. And the number of women who died from abortion plunged from 1920 to 1970 before Roe versus Wade, and the court overlooked those things as well.
Talk a little bit about something you mentioned in passing just a moment ago, and that was the influence of Planned Parenthood Federation's brief filed on the justices.
Well, I think that it might have been the most influential thing filed in the Supreme Court in the cases, and it was filed, I think the second and most influential brief was filed late in 1972, and it was promoting the legalization of abortion. It gave promoted some of these myths. It promoted the notion that abortion was safer than childbirth based on the Soviet bloc data from the 1950s. It was very influential with the justices and in promoting the notion that abortion is safer than childbirth. And it was because of that note. I mean, if you read the Roe v. Wade opinion, you'll see that notion that abortion is safer than childbirth is a thread that goes throughout the opinion. I mean, it influenced the justices to expand the right from 12 weeks to viability. It influenced the justices to prohibit health and safety regulations by the states in the first trimester because, heck, if it's so safe, we'll just let the providers self-regulate and we'll just defer to their judgment. And it influenced the whole scope of the outcome of the structure of the Roe versus Wade opinion and the breadth of the right to abortion. And there was no reliable data in 72, And there isn't any reliable data today to show that abortion is safer than childbirth.
You talked about the expansion of legal protections for the unborn that occurred in the decades leading up to Roe v. Wade. I take it then that Roe v. Wade put a halt to that legal expansion of protection entirely, just shut it down entirely.
You think so, but it didn't. And this is an interesting fact of history as well, because the Roe versus Wade opinion only addressed abortion, which they narrowly defined as terminating pregnancy. It didn't address other ways in which the unborn child can be killed. So it didn't address medical malpractice that might take the life of the unborn child. It didn't address a drunk driver who careens down a street and strikes a pregnant woman and kills her or kills her unborn child. It didn't address the uncommitted boyfriend, a strange boyfriend who strikes and kills his pregnant girlfriend out of rage and kills her unborn child. It didn't address any other circumstance in American society in which the unborn child can be killed except abortion. And it allowed the states to move ahead with protecting the unborn child in all these other circumstances outside of abortion. So the states have actually moved ahead since Roe versus Wade. Many states, I mean, we now have 39 or 40 states with fetal homicide laws that treat the killing of an unborn child outside the context of abortion as a homicide. And 30 states protect the unborn child in that context from conception. We now have 38 states with wrongful death laws, which are the civil side of the law, in which you can get money damages for the family if an unborn child is killed. And we have prenatal injury laws in all 50 states. So the states have actually moved ahead and created what scholars have called a schizophrenia between the court's edict on abortion and what the states have moved to do to protect the unborn child in all other circumstances.
So that has to be just a massive legal confusion. I think your term schizophrenia is absolutely apt there. Where do we see this now, this complete disconnect between Roe and this massive laws that recognize and protect unborn life?
Well, the court has largely ignored it. I mean, it's been brought to the court's attention, but they have chosen to ignore it. You see it in news reports. I mean, in Illinois, for example, there's because of Roe versus Wade, the court has imposed an edict of abortion on demand for any reason at any time. But Illinois is one of the 30 states that has a fetal homicide law from conception and has had one since 1986. Last September was the 30th anniversary of the fetal homicide law in Illinois. And you'll see news reports of a strange boyfriend strangling his girlfriend and killing her and her unborn child, you know, in the Chicago Tribune. And he'll be prosecuted for two homicides. And you'll see news stories like that in other states. So the public hears about it from time to time, and the public is left to wonder, well, how can this be? I mean, it's such a contradiction. How can you prosecute that strange boyfriend but have abortion on demand? So the public sees it from time to time, and I think the schizophrenia is having its impact on public opinion. But the court and the justices have chosen to totally ignore it, and they've never reconciled it, and it's a growing contradiction.
Some might argue, well, the difference there is that in the case of fetal homicide laws, presumably the mother wanted the child. In the case of abortion, she doesn't. And that would make all the difference. How would you respond to that kind of thinking and argument?
Well, that is the difference, and it's all because of the Supreme Court. Because the Supreme Court has basically said that when the child isn't wanted in the abortion context, it's fair game to take its life. But when it is wanted in the fetal homicide context, the state laws can prosecute the perpetrator who takes the life of the unborn child. And it's all due to the court. It's a utilitarian, pragmatic judgment that the court rendered in the context of abortion. But they did not, I don't think the court anticipated some of these developments. For example, ultrasound. Ultrasound didn't come on the commercial market in America, in American medicine, until a few years after Roe versus Wade. I mean, it was like 77 or 78 when ultrasound hit the commercial medical market. And I think the justices were blindsided by it. They didn't anticipate it. Dorothy Beasley, in the oral arguments, if you go to oyez.org website, you can hear her talk about fetology and fetal medicine, but she never mentioned the word ultrasound because it wasn't on the market and it wasn't entirely anticipated. In addition, I don't think the justices, because of their misunderstanding of what was happening with abortion law and that it was enforced and what was happening with prenatal injury law, they didn't anticipate that the states would move ahead with greater legal protections in the context of wrongful death and fetal homicide and prenatal injury. And that the leaving the states open to move ahead, the states have done so, and it's created the schizophrenia. So it's the justices, I think, have been blindsided by these developments and did not really anticipate them.
Clark Forsyth is our guest as we talk about the real history of Roe v. Wade. On the other side of the break, he writes about a public health vacuum that the Roe ruling created. We'll find out what that is after this. What are some of the myths of gospel reductionism? I've written part two of an article titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joy Pullman of The Federalist writes about her journey from charismatic experientialism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
An umbilical cord of biblical truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on the Sunday night, January the 29th, the real history of Roe v. Wade. Clark Forsyth is our guest, acting president and senior counsel for Americans United for Life and author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. Before the break, you were talking about the legal schizophrenia that has prevailed since Roe. You also write about a public health vacuum that was created by the Roe ruling. What do you mean by that?
Well, based on the myth that abortion's safer than childbirth, the justices decided to prohibit, and expressly did so in Roe versus Wade, prohibited the states from enacting health and safety regulations in the first trimester, the first 12 weeks, because they were going to let providers, practitioners self-regulate and use their own judgment as to safety of the procedure. But the first trimester is when 90% of abortions are done. So in 90% of the cases, the justices prohibited the states from enacting, adopting, and enforcing health and safety regulations. And perhaps a dozen states or two dozen have moved ahead with health and safety regulations, but only in recent years. And the court created this public health vacuum, and we've seen the the impact and the dangers to women from substandard conditions and substandard providers in abortion clinics. Last month, December, Americans United for Life released an extensive report entitled Unsafe, how the public health crisis in America's abortion clinics endangers women. And we have a multi-state analysis of the substandard conditions and substandard practitioners in many states who are under investigation for violations of health and safety codes, who don't check women's vital signs and so forth. And the public health crisis still exists.
If you would, let's talk about whether or not Roe did what many people believed it did, or whether it actually solved the problems that it was intended, or at least ostensibly intended, to solve. How would you answer that question?
Roe hasn't solved the problems that it set out to do, in large part because the court misunderstood what was going on and did not have a trial of evidence and an evidentiary record to assess what legalizing abortion was going to do or the health risks of abortion. To the extent that women's rights and lives have been protected by the law, it's been done by state legislation or congressional legislation. I mean, the national law that prohibits employment discrimination against pregnant women, the state laws that prohibit employment discrimination against pregnant women, those have been adopted by the states and Congress, not by the court. Roe versus Wade is marketed as this decision which promoted women's rights, broadly speaking. But Roe versus Wade only has to do with abortion, as the court defined it very narrowly, terminating pregnancy. That's all Roe versus Wade has to do with. It's just about abortion and nothing more than abortion. So all the other advances in women's rights and capabilities and equal opportunity in American society are due to things outside of Roe versus Wade and due to cultural and political and legal developments that have nothing to do with Roe versus Wade. And Americans need to understand that.
So you're saying that Roe is often presented, at least symbolically, but often concretely, as a major step forward for women's rights and maybe the spark that got equal opportunity, equal pay, all those things underway, but it had nothing to do with any of those things.
Absolutely. I mean, the Equal Pay Act was enacted in the mid-1960s. I think it's the Equal Pay Act of 1963. And there are Equal Pay Acts in virtually all 50 states. Again, because of Democratic action, because of state laws or federal laws, having nothing to do with Roe versus Wade. So if Roe versus Wade was overturned tomorrow, it would affect the right to abortion, it would return the issue to the states, and it would allow the states to act on the abortion issue, but it wouldn't affect all these other issues and laws, which are much more important for advancing women's rights and opportunities in American society.
What about the argument, Clark, that, well, and you've touched upon this briefly, before Roe, abortion was dangerous, back alley business. Now it's safe and easily accessible. Is abortion safer now than it was before Roe for women?
Well, how do you measure it? I mean, I suppose the technique and the technology has made abortion technically safer as a medical procedure. But if you look at, if you measure it by deaths, if you measure it by deaths to women, you can see that the National Center for Health Statistics show that the deaths to women from abortion plummeted from something like 1,600 in 1920 to something like 35 in 1972 annual deaths, which all preceded Roe versus Wade and were due to the advancement of antibiotics and medical procedures leading up. I mean, that happened before Roe versus Wade. So in terms of number of women dying from abortion, all that progress preceded Roe versus Wade, and Roe versus Wade has not had that impact.
What about the tenor of public opinion. We're often, at least we're often given the impression, if not told outright, that Roe is settled law, that the American people agree with it, and that Americans want their abortions safe, legal. It used to be rare, but that's now no longer being said. Safe and legal and easily accessible. Is that really American public opinion?
No, not as you've described it. I mean, if you look at the Gallup polls, and I have the annual, in abuse of discretion, I lay out the annual Gallup data since 1975, and it shows that a majority of Americans do not support the sweeping scope of Roe versus Wade. They only support abortion in certain circumstances. And only a minority of Americans support the sweeping scope of Roe. And if you look at more recent polling data, you'll see that a majority of Americans would prohibit abortion after the end of the first trimester. They would prohibit second and third trimester abortions entirely. But as you know, the question or the problem is that Americans don't understand what Roe versus Wade did. If they think it legalized abortion only in the first 3 months, they misunderstand the decision. And that's part of the problem. If you ask Americans, do you support Roe versus Wade, what does that mean? And so if you ask Americans more specifically, do you support abortion in the third trimester or the second trimester, a majority of Americans say no. So it's important to more specifically say, do you support abortion in the first trimester and for what reasons, or the second and third trimester? I think the polling data will show that Americans only support abortion very early in pregnancy and only for hard cases. And that's a very different question than Roe versus Wade. If you ask Americans if they supported Roe, abortion for any reason at any time, only 7% of Americans in a 2009 poll from a polling company found that only 7% of Americans support abortion for any reason at any time.
So what would happen the day after Roe is overturned? Go into some detail, if you would.
Very little, in the sense that if Roe was overturned today, abortion would be legal in 40 to 45 states tomorrow, for the simple reason that there are no effective prohibitions on the books in those states before 20 weeks or before viability. Another way of saying it is, whatever is on the books today would be enforceable tomorrow. So if your state has a 20-week limit, a five-month limit, it would be enforceable. Informed consent law, parental notice law, a limit on public funding of abortion, all those would be enforceable. But most states don't have any prohibition on the books before viability or before 20 weeks because they've either been repealed or the federal courts have thrown them out. So there would be very little change tomorrow. I mean, there'd be a lot of, you know, media storm. There'd be a whole lot of debate. There'd be a whole lot of media buzz. And, you know, you'd see press conferences with every governor in the country and every state attorney general in the country asking them, what's the state of the law in our state? Are you know, what's enforceable? You know, is abortion going to be legal tomorrow? You'd see all kinds of media hubbaloo, but there would be very little change. And the issue would go back to the state legislatures and the state governors. And it would be debated over a series of months, perhaps a year or two. And public opinion would be able to have its impact. And I think you would see over a space of a year or two that public policy in the states would more closely align with public opinion. And that would be good for our democracy. And it would be good for protecting life, because American opinion is more pro-life than Roe versus Wade, more pro-life than the court. And I think you would see, for example, perhaps a dozen states prohibit abortion, perhaps except to save the life of the mother. You might see a dozen states, including New York and California, that would leave it largely legal for any reason in the first and perhaps in the second trimester. And then you would see perhaps 25 states in the middle who would limit it significantly and protect life more. And democracy would be able to run its course. And I think that pro-life people and pro-life Americans would over time lead their state by state, back to protecting life.
With about 30 seconds here, as an attorney, was Roe v. Wade good law?
It was a disaster, and it was an unconstitutional and lawless decision that has no basis in American legal history or in the text structure history of the Constitution. It was a lawless act, an unconstitutional act, and we have to hope that the Supreme Court will overturn it as soon as possible.
Clark Forsythe is acting president and senior counsel for Americans United for Life. He's author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. You can purchase it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Clark, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be with you again.
This week on Issues Etc., we'll discuss contraception, male and female sex differences, four ways the conscience can be bad, Christ coming to fulfill the law, Jesus calming a storm, and more. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.